All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Mulligan Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. Today we are going to be doing the script reading for X-Men 95. It is Claremont's second issue on the run, and this issue is infamous because, spoiler alert, it is the death of John Proudstar, Thunderbird. In honor of John, we are celebrating John Proudstar on the show this month, all month. Most of my guests are our Native American writers, creatives, actors, artists, and we get to do an academic panel at the end of the month that we are titling About John Proudstar, where we get to talk about the relevance and history and resonance of this incredible character. Today we're going to be reading the script from X-Men 95 in August 1975. Chris Claremont is co-writing with Len Wein here. We've got Dave Cockrum on pencils, Sam Granger on inks, Karen Mantlow on letters, Petra Goldberg on colors, and Marv Wolfman is the editor. We also have excerpts from Classic X-Men number 3, which matches this issue, and the backup story from Classic X-Men number 2 by Chris Claremont and John Bolton, with Glynis Oliver on colors, Tom Orzechowski on letters, and Annie Nesenti and Terry Cavanaugh on edits. I'm Chad Anderson. I will be playing your narrator.
I'm Seth Martell as Cyclops and Hegedorn.
I'm Sean Beveridge. I will be the high-flying Banshee and also Catman, but not the Batman villain Catman.
I'm Harum Scarum. I'll be playing Storm as well as Misty Knight.
Hi, I'm George Michael Duvin. I will be playing Colossus as well as Ape Man.
And I'm Brent Wingate, and I'll be playing Wolverine and Frogman.
Scotty White, and I'm playing Thunderbird and Air Force Soldier.
I'm Kevin Canary, and I'll be Nightcrawler and the Sounds of Birdman.
I'm Alicia Wilder, and I'll be Jean Grey.
Demanda Martini, and I am returning as Count Nefaria.
And Justin Wilder as Professor Xavier and Thug.
Typecasting on some of these roles that you guys are hearing. On the cover, the all-new, all-different X-Men. Not a hoax, not a dream. You must read War Hunt. This issue, an X-Man dies. Behind the group, the wreckage of Valhalla Mountain is in the distance. Storm blasts Dragonfly with lightning. Colossus evades a blow from Ape-Man. Thunderbird punches Catman in the jaw. In the background, Nightcrawler lunges for Frogman. Stan Lee presents the Uncanny X-Men in War Hunt. We open on the X-Men free-falling through the air toward the curved earth below. All green hills and purple clouds. Cyclops, Nightcrawler, Thunderbird, Wolverine, Colossus, Banshee, Storm. These are the new X-Men, and in a few seconds, they will all be dead. Unless, impact minus 100 seconds. In the corner box next to the title, against a green backdrop, we see the heads of Banshee, Colossus, Nightcrawler, Storm, Wolverine, and Cyclops, all grouped. You'll notice only one of the X-Men is not pictured here, and that is Thunderbird.
Thanks, Cyclops. Think. You can't give up now.
Impact minus 90 seconds. And thought has given way to action. Memories first flashing insanely, kaleidoscopically across Cyclops' mind as he falls. Memories of how the Beast had contacted the X-Men to tell them that Count Nefaria and his Animan had taken over NORAD headquarters and gained control over America's nuclear arsenal, that Nefaria was holding the world for ransom. The X-Men had flown to stop him, and Nefaria shot them out of the sky, twice. Now the X-Men are falling to their deaths, their mission a total washout, and memories have given way to action.
Storm, Banshee, listen up, you two. Each of you grab a pair of X-Men and head for the ground. Nightcrawler can teleport.
But I cannot, Cyclops, not from here.
What?
I can teleport, yes, but if I teleport from this height, the law of conservation of energy demands I materialize with the same velocity I started with. I will be killed regardless.
Do not worry, Kurt. I can carry you and Colossus easily.
Rodro, no, I can get down on my own. Take that crazy man, that Wolverine.
Peter, don't be a fool.
Don't argue, Storm. There isn't time. So, both of you, get out of here now.
Banshee grabs Thunderbird's hands while Storm rushes to save Wolverine and Nightcrawler.
Cyclops, lad, I haven't enough lift to carry two grown men. I'm sorry, but I have to come back for you.
Well, I'll see you around, Banshee. Just don't be too long, huh?
Impact minus 63 seconds, and the mutant called Cyclops is alone. Colossus is the first to land, if one could truly call this a landing. In his metal form, Colossus hits the ground with a massive shakow! For a moment, all is sound and fury. The force of the impact whip-crack tracking down the mountain, and when the sound fades and the fury dies, Colossus is nowhere to be seen.
Darno, the lad's killed himself.
Sheesh, and that nut had the nerve to call me a crazy man.
Peter, are you there? Are you all right? Peter!
As Storm delivers Nightcrawler and Wolverine to the ground, Colossus steps out of a massive crater, completely unharmed in his metal form.
Why are you yelling, Ororo? Of course I am all right. Why wouldn't I be? What kept all of you?
Impact minus 37 seconds.
Come on, Banshee, get the lead out. You're not up here soon. You're gonna be scraping me off the mountain with a very thin spatula.
Impact minus 12 seconds.
Looks like this is it, Summers.
Impact minus 5 seconds.
Funny, I always figured my number'd be up someday, but I never thought it'd end like...
Gotcha!
Yes!
Just before Cyclops hits the ground, Banshee grips him under the arms and takes off into the sky with a scream.
You know, you sure took your time about picking me up, Banshee.
Oh, laddie, did you really think I'd let a fine broth of a boy such as yourself get splattered all over that cold, cold mountain?
The thought had crossed my mind.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Cut the comedy, Banshee. We've got work to do.
A fine broth of a boy.
Yeah, like, so Cyclops is really just like unspiced chicken broth, right?
You can't eat broth with a spatula, just saying. Inside the base, Count Nefaria is excited. Accepting ransoms from various countries around the world while he watches the X-Men fall on camera. A politician named Hegedorn appears on a screen. Count Nefaria blows elaborate smoke rings from a cigarette while Catman crouches nearby. The other Animen wait near a pile of bodies, all the soldiers from the base.
Those aren't the X-Men I remember. The team has changed. Not that it makes the slightest difference. Whoever they are, whatever their talents, they are history. Tell me, Hegedorn, do you really believe that paltry band of misfits was a match for Count Nefaria?
We had no choice. The president will never give in to your insane demands, Nefaria.
I have total control over Valhalla Base. The entire Cheyenne Mountain complex is sealed, making it virtually impregnable. Consider this your final warning. Tell the president to meet my terms, or I'll unleash Armageddon!
All the base personnel are locked up tight, boss.
Sorry.
So good.
Excellent, Catman. A textbook operation.
You're bluffing, though, right? Sure, we control the entire United States, land-based strategic missile force, but if we launch them, then that'll be the end of the world, including us.
So, you need not worry, my NMN. The government will pay our ransom because it has no choice. I may indeed be running the greatest con in history, but they dare not take that risk.
Mountain real good to keep out puny soldiers, but what if the Avengers come?
We'll deal with them, Ape-Man, as we did the X-Men.
That'll be the day. But we're good, but not that
don't! Good. Valhalla's own internal security forces will destroy any intruder for us once Dragonfly's hypnotic glare has made them her abject slaves.
You guys, I'm gonna write a whole Count Nefaria and the Animen story and just have us all read it out loud. It'll be my favorite thing.
Please do that.
Sold.
The seven mutants regroup on the ground, remembering the deadly mission ahead.
All right, X-Men. According to General Fredericks, we've got less than an hour to deactivate the Doomsmith system before it automatically fires every ICBM in the U.S. strategic arsenal. So, our first step is to get inside Valhalla Base.
How are you going to do that, One-Eye? You got a key that'll crack open a mountain?
As a matter of fact, Thunderbird, I do. And the name Cyclops, mister, not One-Eye. Understand? Nightcrawler, teleport inside. Those same missiles that shot us down came from around here, which means there's got to be a surface access hatch.
Easier said than done, Cyclops. I cannot teleport anywhere I cannot see or visualize in my mind's eye. Yawning blind is virtual suicide. There's too great a chance of me materializing within a solid object.
Oh, that does sound a wee bit awkward.
Sound waves penetrate rock. Banshee, could you use your scream as sort of a sonic sonar to find Nightcrawler the open space he needs?
I've never tried, but that does mean it can't be done. Only drawback is my effectiveness seems to decrease the deeper I probe into the mountain. The outer wall is too thick. This stunt proven harder than I thought, or maybe I'm just too old for the job.
After emitting a long series of screams, Banshee falls backwards into Storm's arms.
Banshee?
I'm fine, lass. Just a wee bit winded is all.
He's pale as a ghost. Did I ask too much of him?
Nightcrawler, there's a fair size space 51 meters lateral from here by 7 vertical up. If you can match those coordinates, bucko, you're in.
It's as good as done, Cyclops. Teamwork, my friends. How I love it. See you soon.
Editor's note, this is an additional pay
Rage from the classic X-Men story that seems to explain how Nightcrawler was able to teleport into the base in the first place, because that's not how his powers work. So many years later, Claremont got to tell us it was Banshee's sonics that made it happen. And seemingly oblivious to the danger, Nightcrawler vanishes in a crack of flame and a gusting stench of brimstone, and Nightcrawler is suddenly gone. Bamf! Only to reappear a split second later, deep within the man-made labyrinth that is Valhalla Base.
At least I think it is good as done. I am inside Valhalla at any rate, in some sort of maintenance tunnel, but how am I to find this missile base Cyclops spoke of?
I wouldn't worry about it if I were you, Mutie. I'd worry about staying alive.
The bizarrely mutated frogman jumps into the teleporting blue mutant, kicking him with both feet. Pow!
What? You're still conscious? But I hit you hard enough to flatten a dozen men.
Perhaps. But, like yourself, Nightcrawler is not precisely a man.
Nightcrawler evades Frogman's jump by leaping up into a panel in the ceiling. He then crawls along in the shadows, out of sight.
It doesn't matter what you are, Mutie. Nefaria wants you dead.
Then his agents will have to do a far better job than you are doing, Herr Frosch. I do not wish to hurt you, Herr Frog.
Don't call me that. I am not a frog. I am not a freaking mutant like you. I am a man. And I don't need no help stomping you into the ground. No help at all. Where did he go?
Bamf! Nightcrawler teleports off the wall and lands behind Frogman, who he then knocks out with one punch.
Nowhere, Herr Frosch. Nowhere at all. And now, Herr Frosch, we will go and find my friends, and then you will tell us all we wish to know about your master and his plans.
Nightcrawler grabs Frogman's shirt collar and drags his unconscious form down the hallway. And speak of the devil, on a nearby screen, Count Nefarious sees Frogman's defeat as Dragonfly and Catman wait for instructions.
Croaker, you unmitigated idiot! You had to try and defeat the X-Men on your own. You couldn't have summoned aid.
What's the hassle, boss? The rest of us can go after the Mutie and take him easy.
No, let him be. I have other surprises in store for the X-Men.
Boomsmith minus 43 minutes. God, there's a lot of countdowns in this issue. It doesn't take Nightcrawler long to find the missile bay, but even those few minutes are minutes the X-Men can ill afford. Nightcrawler puts down the body of Frogman, who soon wakes up and sneaks away as Wagner discovers how to open the door to the outside.
All I have to do is find a manual override control. Ah, there it is. The Frogman! He's gone!
With barely a sound, the heavy blast door lifts high into the afternoon sunlight.
Nightcrawler! All right, people, we've got our door. Let's get inside.
We have a problem, Cyclops. I had a prisoner, a talking Frogman, but he escaped.
Can't be helped, Kurt. We all make mistakes. The sooner we're in the command post, the better. So let's move it, X-Men.
All goes well at first. Almost too well.
Cyclops, is it my imagination, lad, or is it getting a little bit stuffy in here?
Oh, Irish has a point, One-Eye. I feel kind of woozy myself, and I ain't felt this way before.
There's your answer, Banshee. Gas.
Cut over to Count Nefaria going, poppies, poppies. The mutants turn and see a wall of gas in front of them. Before the X-Men can react, the gas cloud is on them. If the X-Men let that moment happen.
We've got to get out of here. All of you, smash through that wall into the next tunnel.
The Air Force designed this complex to survive anything. Nuclear war, biological holocaust, even a meteor strike. Trouble is, they never expected the X-Men. Doomsmith, minus 35 minutes.
Cyclops, look, a squad of American soldiers, and they do not look at all friendly.
That may go down on record as the understatement of the year. Armed Air Force soldiers open fire with quick-firing rifles. Colossus, in metal form, stands in front of his allies as the bullets bounce off his body. The others jump to safety behind a wall.
Get those muties, men! Kill them all!
X-Men, get behind me. I will shield you from the bullets.
Cyclops, we cannot stay here. If we do, the gas will overcome us.
I know that, Storm, but we can't hurt those soldiers. They're not responsible for their attack. Look at them. They've been hypnotized.
Very well. If you do not want these soldiers hurt, they will not be hurt, but they will be stopped.
Raw energy crackles in the still air, lightning flaring bright around them as a wind springs up from nowhere. And with the wind, a sound never before heard within the safe, secure confines of Valhalla's base, the sound of running water, the sound of a flood. Waves of conjured water rush down the hall, wiping the soldiers away. It gathers the soldiers like a living thing, gently sweeping them down the long corridors until they are no longer a threat to the X-Men. And then it sets them down and fades away as quickly, as quietly as it had come.
I think we may proceed now, Cyclops. The soldiers will not bother us anymore.
Maybe not the soldiers, but the Air Force security troops aren't the only threats lurking in the vast silent halls. Not by a long shot.
I'll take the point, One-Eye.
That's Wolverine's job, mister. You stay with the team.
The heck I will. I'm as good as a scout as a midget.
No, you're not. And especially not here. Wolverine was stationed at Valhalla Base while he served in the Canadian military, and his ultra-keen senses are the best equipped to stop the opposition.
I'm a part of this team too, Cyclops!
Good. Then you'll have no problem following my lead.
Lost my temper. Too easy. Happens too often. I hate being bossed. Why am I in a team? Psych was right about the Canuck. I knew it. I still bucked him. I want to contribute, to be needed. My being here, being alive, should count for something. But how? There's nothing I can do what the others can't do better. Nothing!
And nearby, Frogman has returned with the other four Animen. Catman, Ape-Man, Birdman, and Dragonfly.
There they are, Gorts.
Gort sees them, Catman, and Gort will kill!
It's so Cookie Monster. I love it so much. Ape-Man leaps onto Thunderbird, punching, and soon picks John Proudstar over his head and throws him right into the Banshee with a walk.
Banshee, look out! He's gonna throw me!
The fight has barely begun, and already two X-Men are out for the count. A bad omen.
Cyclops, it's the Man Frog I told you of.
And he's got the rest of Nefaria's Animen with him. We haven't time to be gentle, X-Men. So take him down. Take him down hard.
Easier said than done, Cyclops, because though both sides are numerically equal, the Animen are fresh, ungassed, literally. Eager for the kill. The X-Men are not. Thus, in the beginning, weakness, fatigue, the surprise and ferocity of the ambush all take their deadly toll. Cyclops fires an optic blast at Birdman. Frogman leaps at Nightcrawler. Storm lunges at Dragonfly in the air. Colossus strikes Ape-Man with a punch to the jaw, but Ape-Man counters, knocking Colossus into a wall of machines. And Catman leaps on Wolverine, avoiding the sharp adamantium claws and countering with claws of his own, knocking his foe into more machines.
You think it's some hot shot with those metal claws, Beauty? Well, my claws ain't fake. They're real. And they can kill.
Not where Colossus lives.
Huh? Who grabbed my arm?
Colossus shifts course, grabbing Catman's wrist and pounding him into the wall.
I grabbed it. I, Colossus. And while Colossus lives, the Wolverine will not be harmed.
Meanwhile, Frogman is able to dodge Nightcrawler's punches, but not a certain optic blast.
Nice try, fella. But you ain't dumping me so easy this time.
Oh no! My thanks for your assistance, Cyclops!
My pleasure, Miss...
Cyclops, look out!
Birdman slams into Cyclops, then wraps his talons around his shoulders, pulling Cyclops into the air. But he didn't account for Nightcrawler's agility. With a leap, Nightcrawler slams into the winged villain's back.
Too late! The Birdman has him prisoner! Cyclops is lost unless I can return the favor he did me! Like so! Rock!
Ape-Man turns on the mutants, bounding over the unconscious bodies of Birdman and Frogman.
You hurt Gort's friends, and you hurt Gort! For that, Gort will kill you all!
Heads up, you guys. Here comes that Road Company Hulk, and he looks loaded for bear.
But Storm is ready with a blast of oddly pink lightning, which I think is a Janelle Monáe song.
It is, I think. Wait, hold on. I think not.
Son of a gun. That futzer's still on his feet. What say we,
As you wish, mine friend.
Wolverine and Nightcrawler hit the Ape-Man at the same time. Whammo! But Dragonfly is there with a hypnosis beam for Cyclops.
The Animen are defeated. I must flee to warn Count Nefaria! Hear me, X-Man. My will is your will. You cannot resist my hypnotic powers.
My mind! She's in my mind! I can't keep her out!
Normally, Cyclops is so into that. In a moment, Dragonfly's spell is complete, and behind Cyclops' ruby quartz visor, his eyes go blank and open wide. His eyes motion automatically, raising the quartz crystal shield, freeing his eye beams from their cage. The results are predictable. Dragonfly takes the blast to the abdomen with a zrap.
We've beaten the mountain, and we've beaten Nefaria's Animen. All that's left now is the good Count himself, and we'll be home free.
Doomsmith minus 18 minutes.
Wait a minute. Where are Banshee and Thunderbird?
Out cold. That gorilla wasted them pretty good.
We'll have to leave them here. We haven't time to wake them up. We've got to get to Nefaria and the Doomsmith system.
Nice thought, Cyclops, but Valhalla's a huge complex. 3 cubic miles of corridors and cubicles, and by the time a body's found the place he's looking for, it can sometimes be too late. The X-Men find a computer with a countdown, and there are only 9 minutes left.
No! Nefaria's locked the Doomsmith system into a self-destruct circuit. It's armed and counting, and there's no way on Earth we can shut it off in time.
Cut to a pair of very weary heroes. Banshee and Thunderbird have awakened among the unconscious forms of the Animen.
Oh, aching back. Thinking I'm getting a mite too old for this sort of roughhouse.
Speak for yourself, Irish.
Look above. Will you look at this mess? Must have been a grand and glorious fight.
Yeah, looks like they didn't need our help for anything, figures.
Cut again to one of Valhalla's hangar levels. Count Nefaria makes a strategic withdrawal to the waiting aircraft.
The fools! The X-Men think Count Nefaria is beaten, that they've won. But the very moment of their victory will be the moment of their death. The movement of Nefaria's greatest triumph. The self-destruct system will blow this mountain and all in it to the deepest pits of hell. And when that happens, Count Nefaria will be all gone. Huh? I recognize them from the monitor screens. They're 2 of the X-Men.
As Count Nefaria activates the plane, Thunderbird and Banshee come bounding into the room. And with little time to think, Thunderbird jumps on the back of the plane as it takes off. Panicked, Banshee flies behind him.
Hey, Irish, get a load of this. Looks like that Nefaria dude's bugging out his compadres.
You're too late, mutants. You'll never stop me now.
Once he gets airborne in that Harrier, there's not a crate in this mountain that can stop him. Yeah, maybe not a plane, but a man can do what a plane can't.
Thunderbird!
And
no!
Thunderbird is just that man. Don't go away, Neffy baby, because John Proudstar is coming to get you, and he's a man who don't give up.
Are you crazy, lad? Get off that plane, Thunderbird. I can stop him with a sonic blast, but you've got to get off.
Back in the base, the X-Men get a telepathic distress call from the astrally projected head of Charles Xavier, his eyebrows even bushier than usual.
Psych, we're running out of time. We gotta go.
How far do you think we'd get in 5 minutes, Wolverine? Because that's all the time we've got. Our only chance, the world's only chance, is to try and shut the system down.
Cyclops, what are you doing?
What? Professor, the Doomsmith!
Is totally out of commission. I've mentally scanned the system. Your battle with the Animen destroyed the command relays and the backups. But enough of that. You must get outside the mountain, and quickly. You've got an X-Man in mortal danger.
You heard the man, people. Move it.
And the X-Men move as only X-Men can, but events outside are moving as well. Too far, too fast. Thunderbird punches through the glass to reach Count Nefaria inside.
You madman! You'll kill us both! John Proudstar, get off the airplane before it's too late.
Butt out, Baldy! I'm through taking orders! I've been a loner all of my life, Xavier, an outcast, dumped on by everybody. I'm a man, Xavier, a warrior of the Apache, and today I'm gonna prove it!
For God's sakes, laddie, get off the plane!
John Proudstar's hands rip deep into the Harrier's cockpit, ravaging control systems, computers, electronic hardware, ripping the Technic nervous system out of the aircraft. It's a pounding that no plane was designed to take. Sooner or later, something has to give. Sooner or later, something does. As the other 5 X-Men rush outside, they see the plane careening, and then, whoom!
There they are! Storm! Get after them! Give Banshee a hand! Oh my god!
Thunderbird, no! Get out, boy! But get out!
Cyclops, the aircraft, it's...
I can see it, Peter.
You, Cyclops, and one other. The aircraft hits the ground and explodes in a mass of fire. Rack-a-tham.
Thunderbird, no!
The scenario ends now as it began, with the breaking of Charles Xavier's heart and the twisting of his soul. For in the end, he could not desert his pupil, and all John Proudstar felt, Charles Xavier felt as well. With only one difference, Charles Xavier is still alive. In a series of images, Xavier's face goes from horrified to overwhelmed as he collapses forward on the console in front of him. At the scene of the wreckage, Banshee is in shock.
I begged him, laddie. I pleaded with him, but he wouldn't get off the plane. He wouldn't get off.
I know, Banshee. It wasn't your fault. I suppose it had to happen sometime. Hell, sooner or later, it happens to all of us in this business. It comes with the uniform.
The mutants turn their back on the smoldering wreckage, looking at the horizon beyond. The end. But pause there, because we're going to continue with the backup story from Classic X-Men number 2. This is called First Friends. There's nowhere on Earth quite like New York, and no woman even remotely like Storm. Her true name is Aurora, which means beauty, which she is, without a doubt, in in spirit as in flesh. In her day, she's been both a thief and goddess. All the while, though, she was a mutant, gifted with the power to control the elements. And of those myriad abilities, the one she loves best is to fly. Her cape fluttering behind her, Storm glides through the skyscrapers, over the busy, crowded streets of New York City. She has a smile on her face. She lowers herself past windows, a civilian stare, and lands on the balcony of the home of a new friend.
I am told 8 million souls call this city home. So many people. Right, lady, how can they endure these steel and glass and concrete towers? Where do they find proper air to breathe? And sun and sky and growing green to sustain their inner beings? They must be mad. But if so, then what am I, since I have chosen to join them? Ah, from her description, I believe that is Jean Grey's home.
Aurora, hi. Welcome to my humble abode, my first apartment.
Dressed in a simple greenhouse dress, Jean opens her picturesque balcony window and escorts her friend into her generous space with brick wall interiors.
It is quite lovely.
I lucked out. This used to be an artist studio. That's why it's so huge. 2 sleeping lofts and a big main floor. Pardon the mess, we're still moving in.
We?
The rent's a small fortune. No way I could afford it on my own. So I have a roommate. She's a private investigator. Neat, huh? Misty Knight. Gosh, listen to me babble. It's so weird. I'm really nervous.
In truth, no less than I. More than once, I very nearly turned back.
I'm glad you didn't. There are so many guys in the X-Men. We gals have to stick together.
But I thought you left the team.
In some ways, you never leave. Misty will be home soon. She doesn't know I'm Marvel Girl, so you'd better change out of your costume.
As you wish.
There's a flash of lightning, and Storm makes her very clothes disappear. She stands in Jean Grey's apartment, nude, and Jean chokes on her coffee.
Aurora!
Is anything the matter?
Don't you believe in clothes?
Why?
Take my robe. I'll scrounge you something.
My powers naturally protect me. I have no need for clothing.
And modesty?
In your land, must I be so ashamed of my body that I should hide it?
No, but I'm afraid the society isn't quite ready for such self-possession. Incredible. As a telepath, I can sense it in her thoughts. It really doesn't bother her.
Storm briefly wears a white robe and soon puts on one of Jean's spare dresses, which Jean moves across the room telekinetically. It's a simple dark black dress, but it's a little too snug. Storm's got a little more upstairs than Jean does, apparently.
You're a size larger, but I think this'll fit you.
It floats.
I'm a telekinetic, remember? I can move objects with my thoughts. When you're dressed, we'll hit the stores and outfit you properly.
I am not comfortable.
Just don't breathe or sit down. You'll be fine.
The door opens and in walks Misty Knight, carrying a bag of groceries.
Mom!
Hiya, Misty. Say hello to my friend, Aurora.
Hello. Great name. Love your hair. Wait till you two hear about this new case.
Love to, but we can't stay. Talk later. She's new in town, had an accident, needs a new wardrobe. Gotta run. See you later.
A pleasure greeting you. Farewell. Bye.
Much later, Storm is dressed in a yellow dress with red adornments, and both women have bags on their arms. They each have an ice cream cone as well.
I like ice cream.
One of life's naughtier little indulgences.
So much to wear, and so complicated.
You'll learn.
It is very strange, but very nice.
Brace yourself, girl. We've only just begun.
The street is crowded, and Jean is relaxed, off guard, so she doesn't sense the skateboarder's approach until too late. A little red-headed thug wheels by, hands covered in gloves, and shoves the women, making them drop their bags and their ice cream. Then he steals Jean's purse. The women on the ground are furious.
Oh.
Hey, my purse. Take care of the packages, Aurora. I'll nail the little creep. I can see him, but the crowd's too thick for me to get a psionic fix on the kid. So I can freeze him in his tracks with mind lock. Once he breaks into the open, though, blast. Did he read my thoughts? He's ducking into that subway station. You're not getting away that easily, kid. Wherever you run, I follow.
Jean springs after the kid into the subway tunnels while Storm tries to catch up. In her fear, Storm sees the tunnels seemingly twisting before her into a frightening maw.
Jean went down these steps, underground, so dark, so cold, it chills my heart. But why, bright lady, the walls, the stone, they move, they live, they hunger for me. If I answer, I am doomed.
At that moment on the platform, Jean reaches out to grip the kid's collar.
Got you.
Hey, let go, lady. I didn't do nothing.
Give it a rest, punk, and give me back my bag, or else.
Suddenly, unexpectedly, with an ear-piercing screech of brakes, a train pulls in. Its doors open, passengers alight, scores of people, a multitude of thoughts. So many, too many, hammering at Jean, overwhelming her with images not her own. She sees through different eyes, speaks different tongues, lives, loves, hates, needs, fears, rages, runs, dreams, fights. Until finally, desperate, she wrenches back into herself.
It's gone with my purse. Am I surprised? I was careless, so upset at being caught by surprise, I forgot everything Professor Xavier taught me. I opened my side screens wide, and when I ran into the crowd, I got clobbered. But where's Aurora? She was right behind me. Why didn't she back me up?
Jean moves back up to the surface, where Aurora waits at the entrance, frightened.
Still on the street? What the blazes happened, Aurora? I needed you.
Forgive me, Jean. I do not understand. Do not know. Could not move.
Small wonder. I can see the memory clear as crystal. You were buried alive as a child. Your mother died right beside you. Oh, Aurora, how awful.
How dare you pry into my thoughts? How dare you?
Infuriated, as I would be as well, Storm summons lightning and winds to assault the telepath. Her literal dress is blown off, but luckily Jean had her green mini dress on underneath.
Aurora, no! Stop! Hurricane force winds focused on me. Waste of breath. Never seen anyone so angry. And the weather matching her fury. I can't hold on.
And in that instant, Jean finds herself swept more than a mile into the air. She holds herself aloft with a telekinetic bubble. Storm pursues her, having molecularly constructed her costume around herself once again. Dark clouds gather, blotting out the blue sky.
Can't afford a mistake now. Looks like Storm switched to battle clothes. Got to focus my telekinetic power to keep from falling. If those clouds are any indication, though, things are about to get a whole lot worse. Aurora, for pity's sake, stop this madness before someone is hurt!
Someone already has been, by one she trusted as a friend. This is merely fair payment for that betrayal. My secrets are my own. You have no right to pry.
I didn't mean to. I was scared and angry myself. That's why I lashed out. Do you imagine I like being privy to others' thoughts? When you're a telepath, the problem isn't reading minds. It's not reading them, keeping those psyches out of your own, so you can grab a little peace and quiet for yourself. I'd rather be rid of my power, which would maim me as much as losing yours would, than hurt a friend. And you are my friend, Aurora, whether you believe it or not.
Units of earth and air, what have I done?
A silent command from the Wind Rider banishes her storm as quickly as she summoned it, and a gentler breeze returns the two women to the now deserted street, where their purchases lay drenched in a puddle.
If we're lucky, everybody will assume this was a freak summer shower, and the poor weatherman will take the rap.
Our packages, I dropped them. All those clothes ruined.
Some can be salvaged, others replaced. As Scarlett O'Hara said, tomorrow is another day, and perhaps a better one, provided we have the courage to face it. We all live with demons, Aurora. That a telepath knows better than anyone. The challenge is, do we rule them or they us?
I am afraid.
That's part of it. But will you face that fear?
I want to run back to my home in Africa and a life that is familiar and...
safe?
Yes. But if I do run, I also know that I shall never stop. The darkness, like the future, is unknown and terrifying.
You can beat it if you want. We both can.
Then, my friend, let us do so.
This is a wild issue with people making terrible decisions. If you think you are the person who made the worst decision in this issue, I would like you to speak up first.
Well, as Charles Xavier, every decision I make is terrible. Throwing untrained and uncoordinated strangers into death.
To be fair, Proudstar failed this message. I mean, this was bad. Like, don't, baby girl, don't jump on that plane.
Well, I mean, to be fair, if there wasn't a Wolverine taking my spot, I would have been still being the team. He just, he knew there's not room for both of us.
Thunderbird is feeling some feelings in this issue, Scotty. What's he going through?
He's a sad. He wants to do good, but I think he feels left out and not in charge, and that bothers him. Also, want to know, does he have like a follow-through plan? Like, is he going to jump from the plane? Is he going to try to land it? He just jumps on that bad boy. He's like, I got this.
Blaze of glory.
He just starts ripping into it. Now, next issue, we will see not Xavier really wrestling with guilt, but Cyclops does. Unpopular theory, Xavier just transfers all of his guilt into Scott's brain.
Oh,
checks.
I buy that.
Have any of you seen that art piece of like all of the ex-girlies who have powers transferring their period cramps to Cyclops?
Oh my God. I love it.
Staying focused on the first story a little bit, the death of Thunderbird is very resonant. Outside of the Changeling, who is not well remembered, this is the first martyr for the X-Men, which is very sad. Thunderbird doesn't come back for many, many years, except for those few times he pops up from the dead. Again, stay tuned for our About John Proudstar episode coming out later this month. Really, what happens here is he's kind of a redundant character. He's native, which is wonderful, but what he is doing, Colossus and Wolverine are kind of already doing independently when you take it that way.
True. I mean, they wrote three guys to do kind of the same thing, and that, you know, it's the 70s. Of course the Indian guy is going to get kicked out. I mean, look, I know who wrote this. Different time.
There's a lot of characters that are seen wrestling with this, primarily Cyclops next issue, Xavier, who experiences the death, as well as Banshee, who has to watch John go through this and is unable to stop him. John, beautiful portrayal of Banshee. This is a deep issue for him as he's thinking about being old over and over and over again.
Try to leave right away because he's like, no, I'm an old man. I can't be doing this. This is a young man's game. And they're like, no, you're not that old.
What is it, like 34? What is it?
Right? It's funny, like cutting ahead to future stuff. Banshee dies almost the exact same way for the exact same reason.
Yeah.
And it's
in Deadly Genesis with Vulcan. He explodes in a plane, everybody, if you have not read that story.
Spoiler alert, it gets better.
Storm gets to create a flash flood in the middle of a government base, which is a crazy thing, but it's really fun, the majesty they attach to her powers. That's a thing right from the beginning with her.
I did not know that she could strike pink lightning. I'm still trying to figure that out. But otherwise, she was like very much a support role in there.
And Kevin, welcome back to Mr. Nightcrawler. We get very technical explanations about his powers with the added dialogue, as well as a fun little battle with Air Froche.
Oh my God, I love it. And I'm a big nerd about like powers and things. So I do love that this is like the origin of his like rules about what he can and can't do. But it is funny how all I say in this entire episode is like, I talk to Cyclops. I might be in full group things, but all I say is Cyclops again and again and again. Even when Banshee goes in and checks the thing, I thank Cyclops.
I want to know how Nightcrawler like figured this out. Like he figured out like the science of his powers. Like, did he try to like teleport somewhere and he lost like a toe or something?
There's
like
the reason he only has three fingers.
Exactly.
Oh no, maybe, that's why.
As we know, he has a forked thing. Maybe he lost one of them.
We also get Mr. Duven back with the incredible voice of Colossus. You had some fun moments where he crashes into the ground and they're like, he's dead. And he's like, I'm fine. Like,
it's so he's basically here just to be a Looney Tune, just to make Colossus shaped holes and things.
And then we had our villains for today's episode. Count Nefaria, welcome back.
Count Nefaria! I said it last time, but just the 70s and 80s villains, there's definitely a lot of Skeletor in there, which somebody put me in the chat last time. Because I didn't want to do like any kind of like weird Italian caricature. So I just wanted to be like mustache twirling. Count Nefaria is great. I'm sad he gets blown up in this issue, but he comes back. Like, he comes back so many more times because he's a terrible villain like that.
How does he come back before Thunderbird?
Count Nefaria teleported away, and then he had scientists like power him up with like ionic power, like fucking Wonder Man. That man's made of like ionic energy now. He can't die ever. He's immortal.
I am slightly obsessed with his daughter. She's super cool. She has the whole like, I'm really pretty and really mean, but I'm gonna wear a mask, and then it totally gives me body dysphoria and a agoraphobia, and then she like creates clones of herself. She's wild. I love her.
His daughter's Madame Mask. I didn't know that. I just Googled.
Yes.
Surprise. Alicia as Dragonfly. You got one line.
I was not prepared. I won't lie. I had a moment of, oh no, what was Dragonfly's voice before? But we pulled it off. And it's fine. I was actually kind of happy because I was like, poor Dragonfly. She keeps getting, oh, and Dragonfly's also there. And also Dragonfly is there. And all Dragonfly is also there. But she says nothing. So good for her.
I actually really love Dragonfly. I have a print of her on my wall done by Rage Gear. Her name's Veronica Daltrey. And I want her to star in a streetcar named Desire somewhere. I think she's fantastic. And somebody give Ape Man a cookie.
You know, two of my heroes in life are Monkeyin from Thundercats and Cookie Monster. So they're love child, apparently, in my brain.
Your Ape Man balanced by the Catman and Frogman voices. Like, I couldn't read a few times because I was laughing so fucking hard. Yeah. Let's hear from Catman and then Frogman, please. How did you come up with these delicious voices?
I actually gave it a lot of thought. So there's a series of Flash cartoons that you could see on YouTube called Floating Hands Studios that, like, it's somebody who knows X-Men continuity so well, and you can tell because you could only poke this much fun if you know what you're doing. And in the House of M cartoon they did, Mystique was basically Eartha Kitt, and at first I'm trying to do that. It's like, no, this is not...
Wait, since you're a boy, you could be Girtha Kitt. You're welcome.
I tried. I'm like, no, I can't pull that off. And it suddenly occurred to me earlier today, there's an episode of the Drew Carey Show where there's a battle between the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And Drew's boss says, face it, Carey, your drag is old, our drag is new. And it's based just on that one thing.
It is an honor to play the Frogman.
The character has basically got two inspirations. One is a French friend of mine named Arnaud. I always like to do his accent when I'm around him, but I wanted to push it to 11 with the second inspiration, which is Count Nefaria, because I really believe in this construction of the Animan that it's kind of like it is their own little family that we didn't explore a ton, but all of them are so desperate for love and attention from Count Nefaria that they've got their own personalities and strategies. And Frogman's is to try and lean into whatever homosexuality Nefaria just exudes.
I'm Cyclops really going through it this issue. He's jumping in with a brand new team, put into like the top worst circumstance in a military base where they're all anti-mutant anyway, and nobody's fucking listening. Plus you get to fall out of the sky. Cyclops has not learned his like blast move from X-Men 97 yet.
I feel like Scott really going through it is just every episode. It's just, he's just so wild. I don't know how he was supposed to know that the Doomsmith machine was done. Like, Professor X came in and he's like, you stupid idiot. I'm like, I'm reading it and I'm like I couldn't figure this out when I'm reading it. Like, I wouldn't know this is done. Poor Cyclops.
An X-Men story is just a different person trying to make Scott Summers have a terrible day.
Hey, by the way, guys, we've got 7 minutes till the Doomsmith machine, just to let you know.
Okay, then we get this delightful story, palette cleanser afterward, with Storm and Jean Grey, their friendship kind of blooming. They're both going through it. Jean had like 4 cappuccinos right before Storm arrived. Alicia, this is my single favorite episode I've ever had with you on. Your reading of Jean here was just so exasperatingly wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I had a lot of fun. I thought that it was like interesting to think about like Jean just exploring the freedom that she never had as a kid. Like, she's just like, oh my God, and look at my apartment, and look at over here, I have a coffee maker and I can wear clothes and it's fun. You want to go to the mall? Like,
here, put on my dress, but don't breathe and also don't sit. You'll be fine. Oh,
yeah. It also is just nice to be like, yeah, that's being a girl.
Or a drag queen or a cosplayer.
Yes. Yes, you're right.
And Hera, my word, this story for Storm, it's gorgeous.
It was so nice to finally get from the countryside into the city, see what everybody was talking about regarding the concrete jungle, see what apartment costs actually were back then or whatever, because there's no way that this apartment is affordable.
Are you kidding? But also, what does Jean do? Because Misty is a private investigator, but what is Jean doing? Going to the mall.
We're going to assume she's back in her modeling career.
Okay.
No, that's real. Honestly, Storm should be able to be naked in New York. That's all I'm really saying here.
There's two moments we have to talk about. Storm just kind of tearing her clothes off and like, what? What's wrong? And Jean's like, oh my God, your tits are huge.
You know, people have told me this actually in person before, whenever they see my tits for the first time unclothed. Like, so I feel it. I'm really there with Storm right there. Like, I really felt embodied in the role at that point.
We get more of this next, literally next script reading, where Storm's in naked in front of all the boys. And it's very funny. It's really fun. The other moment is Jean just kind of ripping Storm's trauma out of her brain, but also speaking it out loud. Wow. Wow.
What?
Like, wild.
So like over the fact that Storm did not help her chase down this child from her purse. Like, these are low stakes, Jean. Maybe take a breath.
I mean, it's just setting the stage for Jean later.
in life, just continue to do
like always picking in people's brains just a little bit to see what's not really at the, that's like deep-seated trauma right there. That's not surface level, but I guess like it came to the surface because of the claustrophobia. So that's
right. If you're Dean and you're like, oh, that's there, just you don't need to be like putting that on full display in the middle of the street. Just keep that to yourself.
We had a discussion in the Franklin Richards episode. There's a character named Trauma from the Initiative who's now a therapist, and Trauma's power is like he'll manifest as your greatest fear in your therapy session. So like, where someone was like, he's a good therapist, and I'm like, that's not good, that's like the worst kind of exposure therapy. And there's Gene, right? Like, not like you had a hard time, but like, oh my god, your mother's dead body was on top of you in the wreckage. Like, good lord, Gene, what the hell.
Less graphic, girl. Less graphic.
So there's a lot of deeply resonant moments. Xavier experiencing Thunderbird's death. Thunderbird's death is obviously a huge one. The defeat of Count Nefaria. And then the Storm and Jean friendship that we get to kind of follow up with afterwards. This is such a wonderful gathering. And every voice, every line was just, this is so fun, you guys. Thank you all for being here. Let me call on you each one at a time. Let me hear some of your favorite moments.
It's the Anaman and Nefaria. I would follow them anywhere. I would watch that entire cartoon series, every second of it.
Demanda.
I loved Alicia's Jean because like Jean finally gets to like be Jean and like be a girl, because like she's what, 17, 19, like somewhere in that area. And like she doesn't have to be mom to the boys right now. She gets to like be a girl and just do girl things. And you just pulled it off so sweetly. It was great.
Oh, thank you.
I love her and Misty Knight roommates. I wish we saw more of it.
I like Thunderbird's inner monologue. He's just such an asshole. And then he's like, well, maybe I shouldn't be an asshole. And he's like, no, nah, we're going to continue being an asshole. I love his inner monologue. It's this issue and the last issue when he has these really deep thoughts with himself that he's like, I should do better. And he just does it.
We get to explore about four different stories this month on my show that are like stories about Thunderbird as part of the X-Men before he dies. They're all in weird places and they're like weird anthology spots, but watch for those as we move forward throughout this month. There's more depth to this character added later, but you have to look for it. Brent.
So obviously Storm and Jean, fantastic, really great back and forth. Nightcrawler, fantastic. I mean, that was great characterization. I feel like the voice is fully there. My shout out moment for this issue has to be Catman and Colossus fighting, where Catman's arm is grabbed, screams, "Who's grabbing me?" And Colossus takes the time to explain, "It's I, Colossus."
And Sean.
One of my favorite moments is going to be one of my two shout outs. So Harem is playing two different characters and they transitioned between the two of them. Like they're talking directly to each other and they just switched characters perfectly. It was absolutely flawless. My second shout out is going to Seth as Cyclops. At one point early on, Cyclops just says, "All right, X-Men, let's go." And you said that and I'm like, okay, let's go. Like,
I just listened to the cartoon a lot.
Your earnestness there is so good.
Do you all think that like the Animan were international bad guys for the international team of X-Men? Like they were French and I mean, it's like, it's so weird that they like were so such caricatures, but they were really fun for this reading, but they seemed so silly for back then. But I guess everything was kind of silly back then. I think my favorite part was like how weak all the fake outs of death were this episode. Like, you know, the cover is like an X-Men will die and Cyclops almost smashes into a mountain and Banshee almost passes out. And then finally Thunderbird dies. And you're like, yeah, guys, like we kind of figured it. He's the main guy on the cover.
I have an Animan episode out there. The Animan are initially a group called the Organization, and they're helping like a corrupt businessman in New York try to become the mayor. It's an old Daredevil story by Wallace Wood. You can go listen to me and Matt Horak talk about it. They're fully mutated. Before they were just people in suits. And then they come back again as a group called the Unholy Three. And there's like multiple versions of the Animan ever since then. I think they're all implied to be American, but Frogman's name is François LeBlanc, right? Like, so it's very easy to make him French for sure. Hera.
For one, Duven, love Gort voice. Gort really speak to caveman part of brain, if I'm going to be honest. Alicia, it was wonderful to bounce off of you with Jean in store. I love that. That was like one of my favorite things. Mm-hmm. And then big shout out for Frogman being like so internalized just racism there is crazy. crazy to me. Call somebody a mutie and I'm like, oh my God, my guy, look at yourself. Understand where you would fall in society as well. You're right there with us, buddy.
I especially love that we get like the like canon fact that Storm's boobs are bigger than Jean's. Like that makes me really happy. Let's go Alicia, Justin, and then Duven for final for shout outs.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Okay. I just have to also say, Harem, I was having a great time just bouncing back and forth together. That was chef's kiss. So good. I don't know. For me, I really enjoyed the Nightcrawler Frogman back and forth. Because the way that Nightcrawler just kept saying, Frogman, 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 over and over. And then the moment where he like disappears and Brent did so beautifully. Wait, what? Where'd he go? Like, just such a nice tonal shift there. But yeah, I lived for this episode. I was dying laughing the whole time.
What a delight to come in as Charles Xavier just to tell everyone how they've disappointed him. To offer nothing in terms of what you should do or how to be better, but just from the safety of your home, tell all these people who are risking their lives for your causes, they're doing it poorly. I love the narrator throughout this.
Oh my God, that, yes.
So much just like, well, they're in for us. Like, they really sucked at that one, guys.
Nice try, Cyclops, but yeah. Like I got three of those.
Your reader. And yes, of course, Nefaria, all the animen, all of the voices, were fantastic. It was watching Sean play Catman that was an added layer of delight that you, the viewer, the listener, will never be able to experience. But man, Sean, you brought that full physicality. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have a background in theater. It's Rocky Horror.
Absolutely delightful.
There's like telltale cues, right? Like if somebody's mad, they might flare their nostrils or like raise their eyebrows. Unpopular theory, the madder Professor X is, the bushier his eyebrows are in his psychic projections.
I hate going last because everybody's been talking about all my favorite things. Kurt and Frogman was definitely my favorite thing tonight. Nefaria and the Animan will be missed tremendously.
Nightcrawler's having the time of his life battling this Frogman. He's having so much fun. I loved this whole fucking issue and I love every one of you. You're so talented. I had a great time. Can't wait to come back again next month. Although, Demanda, we will miss you. We don't see Nefaria again for a long, 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 long time on Great Malkin Lane. As we are wrapping up, we're going to put this episode out literally next Monday. This is a quick turnaround on this one. So on March 3rd, everybody stay tuned. In the second half, we're going to be having the incredible team of Carla Pacheco and Pera Perez here to discuss Marvel. It's a series called Marvel, issue number 2. And it's a giant size X-Men story involving gorgeous paints by Dan Brereton. And the next week, we're going to do another Thunderbirds as part of the team story from X-Men Gold number 1, part 4. My guests on that episode are Jim Terry, Wayote Old Bear, and John Proudstar, who is an actor who named himself after John Proudstar. So stay tuned and you can hear about that next time. Follow the show @GrayMalkin_Land on Instagram, and I'd love your support over on the show's Patreon channel where we do crazy episodes on obscure and overlooked characters. Out next on that channel after this episode, you can watch for an episode on a little known mutant called the Gibbon. My friend Theo Chase joins me for that one.
Hi everyone, I'm Scotty White. You can find me at scottywhite.com. I've got one in the spring, one in the summer, Chronicles of Limbo number 3 and 4, so look out for the Kickstarter for that. Also in a toy store. All of this you can find on scottywhite.com.
George Michael Duven, if you're in Salt Lake, come get a haircut. You can find me sweeping up hair after throwing it on the floor. If you'd like some of Chad Anderson's hair, I could save some. I know he's getting kind of big and people, he's famous now. If you want Chad Anderson's hair, make me an offer.
Can I get some of that hair, George Michael Duven?
Okay, I'll switch him up. I'm seeing him this week.
All right, good. New owner of some of Chad's hair, Justin Wilder, coming in. No, you can find me, other half of the X-Wife podcast with Alicia, talking about current comics.
God, I'm so upset by this hair situation. Oh my gosh. Okay, yeah, so I'm Alicia. If you want to follow the podcast, we're on the internet at The X-Wife Podcast. It's THEXWIFE as an X-Men, not former wife. And if you want to follow my cosplay, dance, life journey, you can follow me on Instagram and TikTok at Wilder Moves.
Everybody could follow me if you like X-Men art on Instagram at scmartell.com. Nope, SC Martell. Just the SC Martell. No.com.
Harum Scarum. You can find me on most things as Harum Scarum Cosplay. You might see me floating around as Elphaba currently. So, you know.
Harum, that Elphaba is gorgeous. I saw your photos. You looked amazing.
My niece immediately messaged me because she's on Instagram now and was like, wait, you didn't tell me that you knew. And I'm like, that isn't Cynthia Erivo. That's my friend Harum.
It's literally, everybody kept saying, oh, you look smack like Cynthia Erivo. I'm like, dang, really? I don't see it.
Hi, I'm Demanda Martini. You can find me across most social media these days. I'm no longer on all social media. At Demanda Martini, DemandaMartini. I have back-to-back cons. I'll be at WonderCon at the end of March and then AwesomeCon the week after in DC. I have tons of panels, lots of drag shows. We're doing lots of drag at AwesomeCon. I might be doing a pop-up number during my panel at WonderCon. So please come see me, find out where I'm going to be premiering lots of crazy fun new looks. I have so many wigs to style. Love all of you.
And if you like X-Men or the MCU or anything just nerdy in general, you should check out my podcast, Homo Superior Podcast. We're available wherever those are found. We're also on Instagram at Homo Superior Podcast, where you can find all of our dank memes. We make lots of jokes and they're mostly stupid. And we also have a Discord. The last thing I'll say is Doomsmith minus 6 minutes.
Oh no, we only have 6 minutes left. I'm Kevin Canary. You can find me on Instagram at KAKINIRY. But you can see me in person. I'll be at WonderCon wandering around as well as playing Marvel Rivals all the time. But I'm there mostly to check out Demanda's show now. Now that I know that that's happening, that's why I'm going there. There and maybe there's some leftover bits of Chad's hair on the floor. We'll see if it's in WonderCon.
It's all mine, Kevin.
Also, every Friday on my Instagram, and I try to share it everywhere else, I am doing a weekly series called To Me, My X Treats.
I'm Sean Beveridge. You can find me on the Instant Grandmothers at Cool Beveridge, BEVERIDGE. It is my actual last name. It comes from Scotland, just like my family.
All right, everybody, stay tuned in April. We will continue with script readings. Now, as I say this, this is not a slight to the voice actors. I love all of the voice actors on these. But in April, we're going to be doing the issue where Beast joins the Avengers with a different cast of friends. And we're going to be doing the Champions number one, where Iceman and Angel join the Champions. So watch for both of those. They are really fun, but also the quality of content between the X-Men and these other books is just significantly different. You'll hear it when we read it, but they're really delightful at the same time. I love you all so very much. This nerdy, talented group of people just made my whole fucking day. I'm so happy. Had a great time tonight. Most of this group will be back in May for the next issue of X-Men and Classic X-Men, which involves the first attack of the Ungerai demons. Stay tuned for the second half for my interview with Carla Pacheco and Para Perez. We'll see you there shortly.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. I am so excited to be joined by the powerhouse team of Carla Pacheco and Para Perez, incredible, incredible writer and artist who have worked on a book that I loved together, Spider-Woman, but have also worked on tons of projects that I adore independently of each other as well. I'm so happy to have you both on the show. Let me have you both introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns. Let us know a little about you. Let's begin with the incredible Para Perez. Welcome to the show.
Hey, hello. I'm Para fucking Perez. And friends, he, him. I'm a comic book artist. Right now, I'm working on the TVA comic book. But I've worked for X-Men, many Spider titles, including Spider-Woman with the wonderful Carla Pacheco.
I am the other half of Team Crazy Goat, which is me and Para just being absolute dinosaur-punching idiots. She, her. I did a 2-year run with on Spider-Woman with Para. We also are the co-creators of the amazing Spider-Rex. Mostly done Marvel stuff. Also did Betty Page for Dynamite and some Rick and Morty here and there. Currently, the most recent work I've had, I'll be appearing in the new re-release, the English translation of Metal Hellant's relaunch from Humanoids. The whole bunch of really, really famous science fiction writers and me.
We're going to open with a discussion about Spider-Woman because that's the place we've just got to begin. Jessica Drew has had a crazy history of Marvel Comics, a lot of it weaving in and out of X-Men stuff over the years. More recently, she has had kind of a string of independent titles. She, in your run, is dealing with being a single mother, but has been driven a little bit crazy and is in this high-octane, punchy adventure as just she is rampaging through everything with venom blasts and high kicks. And it's so delightful. The action in your run is so delicious. And it's so fun to see a female character become kind of unhinged in this way. How would you describe your pitch for Spider-Woman when you started this process?
I was literally up a mountain about 3,000 feet up in the Arizona desert when they asked if I'd like to take Spider-Woman in a whole new direction. And I ran around a bonfire for a little bit. And then I ran down to an old mining town to steal Wi-Fi, as you do. You know, I was initially working with Jake Thomas. Basically, just I was like, yeah, I just want to blow up some helicopters. And they very much wanted to go, you know, just see what would happen when Jessica broke bad. I was really excited about taking it really darker direction and just kind of having some really over the top fun with it. Paired me up with Pera, who just became comic soul brother. And we were just off to the races from there. And just working with Peta really, really informed how we built the stories. He and I would get together and kind of just talk. I'd find out what he wanted to draw. Which he and I both come from like action movie and stunty backgrounds. So usually it was something where he's like, oh, I've got this really cool idea for like a Wing Chun knife fight. And I was like, all right, so we're going to go to a steak restaurant and we'll come out with knives. That was the process pretty much for the entire comic.
It's really fun. It becomes most unhinged for me when Jessica is fighting like a pack of clones of her mom. I'm a therapist in my job, and there's something about a character like just punching all of her like evil mother in the face over and over again that's so delightful to me.
Yeah, I still remember reading those scripts for the first time and laughing out hard because like everything Carla wrote was right up on my alley for humor. That's the kind of humor I enjoy. And we share the same, as she said, the same background in action. So for me, that was a perfect mixture between the terrible drama and people doing terrible things and also a lot of humor and a lot of action. So it was the perfect balance. And as soon as we started talking together, we find out how much we had in common and really collaborating on this book.
Yeah,
so it was a great experience.
Me too. It's like, I honestly would very happily spend the rest of my comics career only working with Peta if possible. It's just always just such a joy to scheme up crazy, crazy things. And that is what Team Crazy Goat, because I found out like in Spanish, it's they don't say crazy like a fox. Como una cabra?
Yes.
Like a fucking goat is what the...
Loco como una puta cabra.
Yeah. Crazy like a fucking goat. And so we're Team Crazy Goat.
Those that understand X-Men continuity, this sentence will make sense. I think Jessica Drew's early origins are more complicated than those of Cable, the time-traveling child of Cyclops and Jean Grey. When you're delving into that mess on Mount Wundagore and all of the retcons, it's just crazy. And you really threw yourself in there. I love that you just delved into that continuity so deeply.
Well, it's funny because like there were obviously a lot of options with Jessica Drew because she's had so many reinventions with different creative teams that I could have gone from anywhere. Like I was given the option just completely start from ground zero, but I really like one of my favorite runs was always Bendis's Spider-Woman Origins. And so I kind of used that as my springboard.
I was working on the handbooks at the time and that series retconned some things that the handbook guys were like, no, how do we explain this?
So I kind of, so what's funny is like, I always joke that canon kills, like you can't be so obsessed with keeping the comics tied to canon that you lose track of just making a really good story. But it's also like the beauty of getting to play in the sandbox is getting to use all that rich history. Basically, I try not to step on anyone's dicks. Of just completely ruining what people have done before. But I also, you know, it's like, hey, I brought Miriam Drew back and then a whole bunch of clones of her, you know, her insane clone mother. And there was a lot of material to build from. But I do always love getting some of those fun little details with Wondergore, and Peta always just makes it look so good that it's, you know, it's easy to just keep running with it. Even when I'm making him draw an army of Miriam Drew clones.
It's so wonderful to be in an era where we get to see, I don't know, women behaving badly, I suppose is an easy way to phrase that. But Jessica Drew would for sure step on your dick if it were in her way. Like that's, she would have no problem with that at all.
First issue, I had her throwing a kid off a boat practically by the dick, so...
When we look at her run, the only thing I'm very sad about, weirdly, I'm a weird porcupine Spider-Woman shipper. I was really sad about their breakup.
I just always thought he was kind of a schlub. The porcupine thing, I know our editor, Nick Lowe, like, was a bit more pro-porcupine than I was. So, you know, there were definitely people that were upset about me sending Porcupine off into the great unknown. But I felt like it worked for the story, too. Like, you know, Jessica wasn't treating him very well. And, you know, she was being very selfish at the time. So I felt like that was kind of a natural progression of the story. And I bring the baby back from the farm, so... Everyone who was very nervous about me sending Jerry off to the farm upstate got a little nervous there. We definitely ended up having some fun with Jerry, though. The baby fight, I think, is still one of our favorite scenes in the comic.
Steve Fox, in a subsequent series, has aged Jerry up. Hydra, like, made him an adult, and he's a supervillain named the Green Mamba now. So...
Meanwhile, they just yelled at us for putting the baby in danger.
We actively tried to put the baby in danger in every issue since they told us no the first time.
Yeah. And every time they tell us no, the next issue, like, Peta and I would just slide it back in there and just not ask.
We're also in this odd era of dinosaur superheroes. Spider-Rex is delightfully unhinged. Ryan North recently did a full couple of issues of the Fantastic Four where all of the characters are dinosaurs. There's a Captain Britain dinosaur now.
Oh, those are great.
Yeah, it's really fun. Peta, tell us a little bit about your Spider-Rex design. Instead of Peter Parker, it's Tear Parker. Actually, yeah, the P is silent, right?
So Tear Tarker. Yeah, Tear Patarker.
Are you familiar with the backs of the Transformers comics?
Yes.
So it's basically the same situation. They already had the toy design for Spider-Rex, and then we had to create, they came to us to create the story, the backstory, and the villains. But the design, the only design that's not mine on those pages is the Spider-Rex one, because they already had done by someone else.
But yeah, then we got to do, you know, the Green Goblosaur, Mary Jane, Craven was still my favorite.
Yeah, me too. And the lizard, it's pretty great.
Yeah, the lizard is just the lizard who gets turned into Kurt Connor. Basically, as many puns as we could just cram into it, and then Peta would just make it look really, really good. But I was just going ham on the nuts, or the puns. Sorry, I was going ham on the nuts. Yeah,
I mean that sounds delicious. You can also go ham on the nuts, which is just like Jessica Drew stepping on someone's dick. I think it's the same thing.
Exactly.
Peta, my favorite single work of yours is Rogan Gambit. It's so beautiful. This series brought together some characters that we love and are so good together. And it's really wonderful.
For me, it was a great experience because it was my first step on the X-Men books. Kelly did such a wonderful job with that miniseries. She really, really knows the characters. She's a huge fan. And you can tell because she connected all the story and the new villain and all that with their past. So they're relationship is like a key plot point for that story because of the way the powers of the villain work. So it's a very, very clever and very heartfelt story. And I just try to do my best. But with that script, anyone could have done a good job.
It's this nightmare scenario of what if you get sent with your ex to an island and you have to do therapy together for 5 issues. But it resulted in them getting married. It's really good.
First punching each other and then getting married.
Well, they have such a complex history, but Kelly did such a beautiful job of weaving complexity. The Antarctica thing, like there's so many amazing pieces. And they're still in the comics, so it worked.
And all those panels were on the scripts. Like you have to show this moment, this other moment, and showing the original panel so I can reference that. So she really knows what she's writing about in that book.
Editors can often be really resistant to delving into the history and continuity that deeply. I'm always pleased as a fan when I get to see those moments. Carla, and we're talking more unhinged dinosaurs if we jump to Sauron. I also loved your run on X-Men Green, which was so fun.
That was a lot of fun, and I felt bad. I was having some health issues at the time, so we're supposed to keep the story going, but Steve Orlando ended up taking it over, I believe, and did a great job kind of wrapping up that little storyline. But no, I 100% did that story just so that I could write Sauron, because he's one of my just absolute evil little favorites from the very iconic. You could do so much with all your powers, you know. You could cure cancers. I don't want to cure cancer. I want to turn people into dinosaurs.
Shout out to my friend Elliot Kalin for writing that brilliant line. It's so good.
Oh, it's so good, so good. When Jordan first sent me the original X-Men Green comics, and Sauron was in there, and I was like, can I put Sauron in X-Men Green? And because initially I was kind of surprised to be approached to write an X-Men comic with a younger female character and everything. And I was kind of like, why do they want me to do this? And then I read it and I was like, oh, they're all assholes. Okay, cool. Now I know why they came to Pacheco. From there, it was just fun writing a bunch of assholes, stealing a boat, and the king of assholes, Namor, getting to send the terrible team out to Wakanda and just dealing with Black Panther and smugglers and just Sauron being an asshole. So that was a lot of fun. I definitely enjoyed it.
For X-Men fans, Pera also worked on War of the Realms Uncanny X-Men, which is also a really fun time. But you've been all over the Marvel Universe, from Deadpool versus Punisher to Iron Cat with Jed McKay, which is so fun, and Carnage. Your run on Carnage is gorgeous and bloody and just dripping red the whole time. Do you want to tell everybody a little about the work you're doing on TVA right now, which is an adaptation of the series that is so, it's just such a complicated story, such a complex universe, quarter of the universe, and such a huge cast. How has it been working on TVA?
It's great, because there's a lot of visual elements that I don't have to design, because they were so beautifully designed for the TV show. It gives me a little more freedom to focus on other areas. It's set on that characters and places of the TV show, but it introduces new characters like Spider-Gwen, a new Gambit variant, James Hudson, which is a Wolverine, Ultimate Wolverine, I guess, in some of the comics. So we've been able to make a very special mix, which is quite different from the TV show, but at the same time, it has the same feeling than the TV show.
What are your thoughts on Miss Minutes?
The new Miss Minutes, or?
Yes, it's such a delightful thing to see, like, this little cartoony clock drawn in. It's, I don't know, it's really fun.
It's really funny, and I've gotten to design two more of them, which are Sir Seconds and Doc Clock. So are the new ones that are appearing on the TVA book. It's nuts, because when you look at the pages, there's like action pages with characters fighting, and there's suddenly a cartoon clock there. Doesn't match the rest, so it's a very interesting mix.
That Ultimate Wolverine design has been really sparking interest. People are really excited about it, which is fun. It's so fun to see this crazy cast. I'm sure there are certain pages you're drawing where you're just like, good Lord, there's 80 people on this page.
Yeah, I'm working right now on the last issue, and the last issue, it's like all the characters together. There's a huge epic battle. It's quite a lot. I guess the other series that really broke me with the number of characters that were in it was the War of the Realms one, because there were so many characters. There was multiple men. There were walls made of cars. So that was a really exhausting title. But I think this one is a pretty close second one.
So talented, man. I think you can draw anything, which is just fun. But I love that you find fun in whatever you're drawing, too. That's very clear to me. Like, you're really enjoying your work.
I think that's the definition for most comic artists. Like, we try to draw anything and we try to have fun with it. But I don't know. It's up for the readers to tell if that's successful.
Just your work on Spider-Woman just exponentially, like, it was already great, but it just exponentially improved just over just even just the course of the series. And your work has just been getting better and better and better with every issue, even if I don't write them all for you.
No, I think that's a matter of the connection. The closer we are collaborating and the more we know what each other likes to do on a page, the better the scripts are and the better the pages look. So it's thanks to you. Thanks to us.
I interview a lot of people, and when I see a team that really cares about each other and really connects, it's so apparent so quickly. There's times that's the opposite. Right? I'll meet people who finish a full project together, but they've never had a conversation. They've never taken time to connect. Often, ask what they want the penciler to work on. Like, I love when I get to see the camaraderie between the two of you here.
The funniest was there was a book that I don't think it's come out yet. Well,
the one with the boat and the assholes.
Yeah.
Another one.
Another one with the boat. I was working on a script that I didn't know who was going to be drawing it. So I write very, very specific types of scripts when I know it's for PETA. Like, I know how to write specifically, this is a script for PETA. For once, I was writing a script and I didn't know who was going to be drawing it. So I had to actually give details on things instead of just like a whole bunch of, you know, like crazy assholes are on a boat, and which would normally be what the script would look like for PETA. And so it's like, all right, so they look like this, this, and this, and this. And then PETA was actually on a break, so they were able to get him to draw it. So he finally got to see a script for the first time since Spider-Woman number one, where it was just the type of script I would write when I didn't know who it was for. So it was pretty funny that PETA then got to draw it anyway. But instead of having the customized PETA script, it was just me just saying, okay, bunch of assholes, and I guess I'll give details.
Both of you have delved in and out of the X-Men universe sporadically in the last few years. Are you big X-Men fans?
I definitely, like, I was, you know, me and my little brother watching the original X-Men cartoon show was really how I got an interest in comics. And one summer I read the entirety of X-Men from the very, very first issue into the 90s. That was a lot of X-Men.
But welcome to my show.
Very, very bored. Yeah. But yeah, so I did. I had a pretty big history with the X-Men. What's funny is I don't feel like as much fun as I had writing X-Men Green, I don't feel like I'm the best writer on X-Men, because there is just so much history that I feel like there's a lot more balls to juggle and too many dicks to step on, as opposed to me being able to just make up a bunch of shit. So yeah, but you know, I definitely enjoyed doing like the X-Men Green. I had Gambit and Deadpool team up and Deadpool Black, White, and Blood, and that was a lot of fun. And of course, I blew up a helicopter, so.
And Para, are you a big X-Men?
Yeah, when I was in high school, X-Men was my thing. It was my starting point to Marvel Comics, and the Chris Claremont and John Byrne run was for me probably my best comic, my favorite comic at the time, one of the top 10 still today. Yeah, when I got the news that I was hired to do Rogue and Gambit, I couldn't believe it. I was so happy. And then when I got X-Men Gold, like a title with the X-Men on the cover, for me was like, I was in heaven. Totally.
Such a beautiful book, and people have so many nostalgic feelings about it. For me, I grew up a queer kid in a very conservative family, and X-Men was like a refuge for me in high school. And then I became the continuity guy, right? I worked in the handbooks. I really delved in. At this point, I consider myself kind of like a comic scholar. It's like a full circle thing. So it's always really fun to hear people's connections to these characters. Now, we opened the show this year in 2025 with Giant Size X-Men number one. We finally got through the Silver Age and we're into the new content. And the episode since Hoffman have been using these little interim issues that kind of connect to Giant Size X-Men number one. Today, we're going to be taking one of those jaunts into a book called Marvel number two. This was a five-issue limited series that ran in 2020 that just had different creators putting together different stories from all over the Marvel universe. And one of them from issue two is by the incredible creator Dan Brereton. Look up Dan Brereton. His pencils and his paints are gorgeous to kind of like an Alex Ross level. They're really beautiful. Alex has a little bit more photorealistic style, where Dan's is a little bit more cartoony. But Dan is the writer, penciler, inker, and colorist on this book, and it's really, really wonderfully done. It's using the entire cast of characters from Giant Size X-Men number one, which includes all of the original X-Men, plus Alex and Lorna, as well as the newly recruited team. They're fresh back from Krakoa, they are in the mansion, and we have kind of that cutaway scene from Giant Size that we love, where they're all kind of lined up on the stairs, and the team is training together. So this is a really beautiful book. I don't know if either of you were familiar with Dan's work prior to looking into this, but what did you think of the art style in this book, Para?
Yeah, it sort of gave me Bruce Timm vibes. I was not familiar with his work prior to reading this issue, so I don't know if that's an influence on him or the other way around, but I always like that the contrast when something's drawn in a cartoon style, but then it's painted in a more realistic way. It looks, when it's done well, it's one of the best combinations that you can get on comic book pages. And also his use of color is incredible. Those pages look gorgeous. And you can tell that's a job he really wanted to do, because you can tell that the artist is excited about doing those pages when you look at them.
Really breathtaking art.
It makes each character's costume really pop in a beautiful way.
I initially was just like, oh, is this Alex Ross? Like, I thought it was just, the story definitely reminded me of like the original Claremont X-Men of getting the team together. I thought it was a really fun and definitely just breathtaking visually fun little story. It was very old school X-Men, which is always fun. And it was interesting, the costume choices.
It's always impressive when an artist gets to manage so many costumes with so many different colors, because with that team, everybody was wearing their own color, and the pages look like somehow cohesive. They'll look like all those colors are fighting against each other.
Mm-hmm. It really is very, very beautiful. The letterer on this book is Tom Orzechowski, who's been working in the books forever, and Tom Brevoort is the editor here. This story is called Danger Room is Down. As we open on the first page, we get a giant group shot of the team all lined up outside the danger room. This is before they've decided who's going to stay and who's going to go. We've got Havoc and Lorna on the stairs behind Colossus and Storm. Packed into the hallway, we've got Iceman, Marvel Girl, Angel, Wolverine, Thunderbird, Nightcrawler, Sunfire, Banshee, and then Beast is fucking hanging upside down from the chandelier, being a little bit too much like he always is. The oddest part of this is there's a weird painting on the wall of like a shirtless Greek man that just is such an odd choice for the X-Men. It really cracks me up. Normally you see like a team shot or Xavier's face.
Wonderful, because you can tell the personality of all of them. Like, all of them are totally in character. The way the composition and the color works, I have nothing to say other than great things.
Carla, are you a fan of the Jean Grey mini dress?
I actually do. Like, I like the old school Marvel Girl, you know, look. I think it's always fun. And the little headpiece, you know, as it's, I liked it from the original, really old school.
So Beast says that they've been called to help train the new recruits. But there's a note on the door that says, the danger room is temporarily down for maintenance, Marvel Girl informs the others. The team is immediately frustrated. Angel's like, hooey, I'll get this open. Thunderbird says, don't strain yourself there, Goldie. Iceman says, it's a test, I'll freeze the lock. Nightcrawler says, I could easily teleport in. Thunderbird tries to rip the door open. Wolverine pops his claws with a snicked and threatens to break into the danger room. But Cyclops and Charles Xavier are watching the entire time. They're looking at the attitude problems between Thunderbird and Wolverine. Xavier calls them so raw. He's monitoring them through Jean's telepathy, but Cyclops gets on the microphone and says, X-Men, this is a test. We will be back to your training shortly. So they're just kind of seeing how the team reacts together, which is really fun. Angel flips his wings around and some random feathers kind of molt out into Wolverine's face. And Wolverine's like, watch the wings, Big Bird. Could get yourself plucked. So gross. That's the grossest thing. No, thank you.
it all established the characters very quickly. Like you got everyone's personality instantly, and it's a very clever way to do everything. Yeah.
We jump to Banshee, who gets to say things like, "Leave them to their foostern and stick with the old codger lad." Sunfire is being bitchy again. He calls them a childish band of misfits, and Nightcrawler keeps taunting him. Beast says, "We gotta keep it friendly. Let's save the aggression for the danger room." To which Wolverine responds, "Sure thing, Cookie Monster," which is also just such a beautiful way to escalate things a little bit.
It also establishes that Sesame Street exists in the X-Men universe.
Beast turns back to Wolverine and says, "It would be your wit mistake to confuse civility with weakness, and it would be your hide I'd make into a fancy winter coat." You know that thing where the bully picks on the nerd and the nerd just doesn't have a very good comeback? Beast tried. Wolverine won the day. So they're all getting concerned about how far Wolverine is pushing. Jean's like, "Professor, everybody's escalating. What are we supposed to do?" But Xavier's trying to monitor their threat levels and see how they respond.
It works really well in escalating the sense of danger that they first establish the characters, and then it's slowly they get more hostile. You're getting the sense that something bad is going to happen. So it really helps to create a mood and a fast pace as the story is moving forward, because you know either Wolverine or one of his teammates is going to explode because he's behaving like such an asshole.
And of course Cyclops is the most upset. He tells the professor, "I don't mind admitting it, Wolverine, not impressed." And Beast is like, "Yeah, cut him loose." And Cyclops says, "I hate to see talent wasted, Professor, but he's a liability and a horse's ass to boot. Plus he wants to fuck my girlfriend." Like, there's very much that energy, which is always really fun. The Scott Jean Wolverine dynamic is always so hilarious to me. Carla, do you ship Jean with Logan or with Scott?
I've always been a Wolverine and Jean shipper. I like the love triangle element, I guess. I definitely, as a kid, I didn't understand why on earth would Jean ever want Cyclops when she could have Wolverine.
Yep.
As an adult, it kind of became like, you know what? Someone does need to order toilet paper for the Xavier Mansion, and someone's got to do the accounting. Way, way back in the early days of Twitter, I once went on a huge long rant about Cyclops is pretty underrated because somebody's got to do all the grunt work. You know, someone needs to know Excel. As an adult, I understood, you know what? Maybe the square who actually takes responsibility for things is a little more attractive than the wild card.
You're Jean Grey and you're polyamorous. You need the Boy Scout who's myopic with the smooth chest that makes love to you, but you also need the short, scrappy, hairy Canadian who's going to fuck you, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's like you need someone to pull your hair and someone to cry on. So
I think I like the way it is. Like the relationship, it's always Wolverine trying to push things and Jean going back to Scott. But you as a reader knows that she's hot for Wolverine. So I like to keep it like that, because if they are a couple, you know that eventually Logan's going to do something stupid and they're going to break up. So that's the best dynamic possible, I think.
Angel turns back to Wolverine and says, "I hope to God the professor sends you packing, but threaten one more of my friends and I promise you'll leave on a gurney." Yeah, what the fuck are you going to do, Angel? Which causes Nightcrawler to fully facepalm. The doors then open just in time. They were just about to fight. And there's this gorgeous shot of like all 15 characters walking into the danger room. You picture them kind of going a little slow motion, right? Like it's one of those action shots. And now we have this giant full page spread of them all leaping into action, which is maybe my favorite page in the whole book. Storm and Lorna up on top with Jean and Wolverine and Beast down on the bottom. It's just beautiful. Everybody gets their own action space. Welcome to the Danger Room, X-Men. Today's lesson, how to stay alive. Now, Para, you get to draw the X-Men in the Danger Room. What locale are they in? Are they punching dinosaurs?
A dinosaur for sure. It's always dinosaurs for sure.
We have our classics and we stick with it, damn it.
So Wolverine walks in. First thing he does is like hit a sensor that makes a bunch of buzz saws come at him. Beast goes, rookie move. And here's Lorna's basic only moment. She says, "We've all done it. I'll help him magnetically," which is bizarre. We see these buzz saws go everywhere and Wolverine almost gets cut, he turns to the beast who helped save him and says, "I owe you a cookie." Like, he's really he's really hammering in the cookie monster thing. Wolverine then, and I think canonically this is meant to be their first time, Wolverine then turns to Colossus. "Say, Colossus, you Russians play baseball?" "Baseball? I'm going to teach you how to throw a fastball." And we get their first fastball special. Of course, Claremont established that, but this is a fun moment where it was Wolverine's idea. And Jean turns to the professor. "You're seeing this, right? Look at Colossus throw Wolverine across the room." And Xavier watches.
"Yes, Jean.
I am. He's raw, belligerent, untamed, and most of all, he's an X-Man."
Fastball special is always my absolute favorite. We did actually, we got a fastball special in on Spider-Woman. I think it was during King in Black. We had Luke Cage.
Oh, yes.
Chuck Jessica into one of the big dinosaurs. So, and then she just proceeds to punch the dragon to death. I love a fastball special. It's great. Like, you know, I'm a tiny little woman. So anytime, you know, someone like larger can just chuck me across the room, I just think that'd be a great, great fun.
So the basic premise of this story, it's just a few pages of the X-Men standing outside the danger room, arguing, and then learning to work as a team when they're pushed in just the right direction, which is just the chaos that we're looking for. And then all the original, you know, quit the team right after this. This is a delightful story, and it's gorgeous. I can't wait to post some of the images, because I think this is a story a lot of X-Men fans haven't read.
I like the fact that they are showing the how it would be to have a guy like Wolverine for real on a team.
Right,
like,
yeah.
In the beginning, he doesn't want to be a part of it. He's hating everyone. Like, there's legitimate questions by the original members. Like, why are we keeping up with this asshole? Like, he's going to get us killed.
Keeps popping his metal claws in my face and threatening to stab me.
Yeah. So it's great joy at the moment where you see him starting to collaborate, and it also feels very organic. It doesn't feel too forced. So it's a great moment.
Mm-hmm. Now, on my show this month, we're going to be celebrating the incredible character Thunderbird primarily. We're covering a lot of his interim appearances, and the academic panel at the end of the month is going to be all about John Proudstar, featuring and amplifying Native creators and Native talent, which I'm so excited about. Thunderbird makes a small appearance here. He has more appearances in modern stuff set back then than he ever did in the original, because he dies two issues into Claremont's run.
Native American myself, it's always fun to see. Thunderbird was always kind of iffy, because could be a little stereotypical, but it helped give a very classic flavor to the issue. So it was fun to see.
I got to put this academic panel together. We haven't recorded it yet, but I've written the content, and I got to rewatch Billy Jack from the 70s, which to me is is the Thunderbird connection, right? Like, he's Billy Jack in the X-Men.
Yeah.
Well, what a joy to have you both on the show. I'm such a huge fan. It's so fun to put faces with names, and I'm so pleased at the camaraderie you have with each other more than anything. As we're wrapping up, where can people find you online, and is there anything you want to plug for March 2025?
You can mostly find me nowadays. I'm on the Blue Ski, the Carla Pacheco. I am hopefully going to be having a Patreon that'll be launching at the end of this month, where you'll be able to see some early comics, my Inspector Pancakes book, the sequels will be posted there, and you'll also be able to possibly get mail from me. And I've really gotten into making soap lately, so I've been making a lot of weird soaps. So maybe you can pick up some weird soaps. Other than that, I've just been kind of hanging out, getting all my bones replaced in a very Wolverine-like fashion. So excited to be getting back to work now, though. So looking forward to seeing people out on the blue skies and the Patreon soon, hopefully, as well.
Excellent. And I hope you're stepping on some dicks along the way, my friend. It's been wonderful to spend time.
Oh, I couldn't not step on dicks if I wanted to.
And you can find me on Instagram at Pera Perez Art. I'm about to finish TBA and start working on a new book that I can talk about. So, but it's going to be awesome. It's one of my favorite characters from all time, with one of my all-time writers too. That's not Carla, sadly.
I know.
But eventually Spider-Rex is going to get us together at some point. Look for our story. We have a story done for Marvel that we did last year and has not been published yet. It's one of those anthology things that they do eventually. So look for us.
There is Black, White, and Blood of a character that shall not be named at the moment, but at some point there is a hidden Pacheco Perez joint somewhere out there, so hopefully that'll be seeing the light of day eventually.
I can't wait. And I also want to go back and read Spider-Woman front to back now that I've met you both, and like just look for these like transcendent moments of joy along the way. Thank you both so much. Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. To keep my own social media private because I got kiddos, the two of you are welcome to add me, just ask. But you can follow the show on @GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram, most prominently. The next episode coming out after this will be featuring the talents of Wayote Oldbear, Jim Terry, and John Proudstar, who is a very prominent actor who named himself after Thunderbird. And then we're going to be reviewing a comic book called Giant Size X-Men #3. So thank you everybody so much for listening.
Thank you.
Next time on the Gray Malkin Lane Show.
Thank you for listening to Gray Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Gray Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Gray Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.